call, but we'll start at the other end of the table. Gene Kranz, the flight director. Stu Roosa, the spacecraft communicator. George Hage, the mission director. General Sam Phillips, the Apollo program director. Chris Kraft, the director of flight operations here at MSC. And George Lowe, the Apollo spacecraft program manager. Gene will start with a summary of this day's activities.
Okay, I'll keep this summary brief since I'm sure that the majority of the personnel here followed the entire operation today in pretty great detail. We picked up with the undocking and separation maneuver in the 59th Rev. We were over the Madrid site, and we had completed the undocking and the separation burn was imminent. It was going to be performed over Tenerife. We got the confirmation on the burn from the Carnarvon site. And immediately thereafter, it was quite apparent that both guidance systems on board the CSM and LEM, as well as the rendezvous radar, seemed to be performing quite well. The crew was going through their first undocked alignment on the LEM spacecraft. Over Honeysuckle, we gave a go for the phasing maneuver, which was the key maneuver for the entry into the rendezvous. And the rest of the 59th Rev was pretty normal. Over the Mercury, we performed the phasing maneuver, and it was a relatively large burn using the descent propulsion system under the AGS system control. We came back up over Texas and got a confirmation on the orbit. This is the beginning of the 60th revolution. Got a confirmation on the orbit, and the crew was proceeding well in their timeline. They were at this time into their rendezvous navigation programs. We had our point of closest approach. This was actually during the football. Before I get into that, that was when we gave the crew their point of closest approach, which was approximately 2.8 nautical miles in that it would be in the football, and we gave them their go to go beyond TPI zero over the Canary Islands site. This time, it was evident from our tracking data and from the onboard guidance systems data that the rendezvous was still completely normal. We passed through the 60th revolution and came back up over the Mercury and gave the crew the go for the insertion burn. This is the one that actually starts us moving over into what we call the right-hand side of the bubble out to a range eventually of about 100 nautical miles. Over Guaymas, the crew performed the insertion burn, and that burn was completely normal. We passed on into the 61st Rev, and the communications today were extremely good. They had many of the people out on the network. We had reviewed our procedures and had more or less tweaked up several of the network sites we'd had some minor problems with. Over Canary Islands, we gave the crew the required updates for the CSI and CDH burns and proceeded to perform the CSI. We didn't get confirmation on the CSI burn until we were over the Carnarvon site. Our communications at the Tananarive site was quite poor. We passed the crew the next CDH time, and again, all of our data sources indicated the rendezvous was normal. The crew were proceeding well in their timeline, and all of the systems were go. From then on, we came across the Redstone in the 61st Rev and got a briefing from the crew on the ascent propulsion system that they had used for their CDH burn. And they said that in comparison to the descent propulsion system, it was a kick in the pants. Our consumables in both spacecrafts were excellent throughout the entire course of the rendezvous, and we were well above our red lines in both the command and service module and the LEM spacecraft. Since the rendezvous was proceeding quite well, we started into the planning for the ascent propulsion system burn to depletion after we had consummated the docking. And at this time, the major activity was entirely on board the spacecraft. We passed the crew the best estimate we had for their terminal phase time, but this phase is generally conducted completely on board the LEM spacecraft. We came into the terminal phase. The crew performed the terminal phase burn. Their mid-course corrections and their entire braking schedule seemed to be completely normal. We had some discussion with the crew on some of the information or testing we wanted done after they arrived in a station-keeping position. Jim, as you're aware, wanted to get docked and have plenty of pad to make sure that he got docked prior to sunset on the 60-second rev. After we finished that, the crew set up the LEM spacecraft for the ascent burn to depletion, and this was conducted about 30 minutes ago. That's all I have.
General Phillips.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, we're now a little over 100 hours into the Apollo 9 mission, which is planned for a total duration of just under 240 hours. So we have a little less than 6 days to go with the planned landing this next Thursday morning at around 10:15 our time here in Houston. The mission thus far has gone exceedingly well. In every way, it's exceeded even our most optimistic expectations, because I think most of you have heard me and others of us say many times that this Apollo 9 mission is the toughest mission that we've tackled to date. At this point in the mission, by reason of the way the mission was designed and planned, we have accomplished all of the primary objectives for which this mission was designed. And we've accomplished a very large percentage of the detailed test objectives and secondary test objectives. Those that remain are important, and in my view, it is important for us to conduct the balance of this mission in the same professional manner that has been accomplished thus far. The mission has served its main primary purpose, namely to get the lunar module into manned operation and to demonstrate a large number of the important maneuvers that the LEM must do and that the command and service module must do and that the two spacecraft must do together and independently. So, from the standpoint of the progress in our planned series of missions, the Apollo 9 mission has made a great stride so far in the little over 4 days that we've flown in satisfying the purposes of that mission. I think I'm speaking for all of the program management when I say that I think we've got a top-notch professional crew in space and on the ground around the world, with which we're certainly exceedingly pleased and very proud.
Okay, before we go to questions, let me make one brief announcement. Immediately following this briefing, there will be a briefing on SO-65, the Earth photography experiment being flown on Apollo 9 here in this auditorium. We'll entertain your questions now.
Could you give us some idea of what the orbital parameters of the ascent and descent stages of the LEM are now and when they might be expected to burn up?
I don't know what the lifetime of each of the stages are, and we can compute that. I have the ascent stage now is 3,759.3 nautical mile apogee. And 3,759.3 and 124.9 perigee. Now, that's a quick look, and that was based on a very short period of tracking post-cutoff. The descent stage should be in essentially the same orbit as the one we had immediately after the insertion, which was about 138.9 by 134. That's about roughly what it should be in.
DeLong.
General Phillips, now that you can talk about a lunar module that has exceeded your expectations, what does the rest of the program look like?
Well, as you know, we've been preparing the 505 launch vehicle with its associated spacecraft for the Apollo 10 mission, and we've been equipping that mission, that vehicle for that mission, and training the crew for that mission. We expect to roll that vehicle out to the pad next Monday, the 10th of March, and it's rolling out with its equipping and all of the preparations for the Apollo 10 mission, as we've described it, the F mission. In a word, the trip to the moon with the full spacecraft, but without a landing. We expect over about the next 3 weeks, as the data from Apollo 9 comes in and is fully assessed, and after the crew is returned and we've had a chance to carefully debrief and assess the performance carefully throughout Apollo 9, to revalidate the decision for the mission sequence as planned, or to modify that sequence if there's a basis for modifying that sequence. And as we've said before, there are two primary alternatives to the Apollo 10 mission, as I've just described it. One of those alternatives is to do another Earth orbital mission, ranging from the one we're now flying in precise detail to some variation of that. And the other alternative is to bypass the 505 launch vehicle and associated spacecraft, pull it back in the vehicle assembly building, roll out 506 with its associated spacecraft, and proceed to a landing. With the status of Apollo 9 today, my own personal view is that the two alternatives stand a small chance of being selected, and that we will, on the basis of the full assessment of this mission, which isn't yet over, will confirm our plans to fly Apollo 10, hopefully in May, and fly the F mission.
Has any action been taken on a recommendation from this center that the F mission stay time in lunar orbit be increased to 63 hours based on uncertainties that Apollo 8 showed about lunar orbit navigation? And what would this play in your decision about whether or not you could make Apollo 10 more ambitious than planned now?
No such recommendation has been made to me. I don't know whether Chris or George would like to comment on some considerations that I'm aware of being given, but it's not been recommended. And that's not to say that it may not. We are continually assessing our plans, as you well know.
John? Was there a question over here? Go ahead, John.
In the revisions to the flight plan and later on during the mission when it was desired to catch up with a little time, I gather that a number of optical sighting tests and star tracking tests and radar tests were deleted. This seems to be a good source of time saving, and I wonder if it's possible to lump them together like apples and oranges. How many such tests were, roughly speaking, were scheduled for the whole course of the mission, and how many of them have been trimmed off?
Maybe I can't give you a specific number in that regard, but I can say this. Most of those special tests that we had planned were planned to give us detailed engineering answers in case systems weren't functioning exactly as they were designed to function. In view of the fact that everything I've seen so far functioned just about perfectly on the LEM, I had no qualms about deleting the test requirements that we had to scratch out, because we're getting the nominal performance of the systems, which we're looking for, in the course of doing the actual mission, in the course of flying the rendezvous, of activating the systems, and so on. So as far as what I have been able to see so far, of all that we have learned, we haven't really lost anything that we were looking for.
But the tests that were deleted in the change to the flight, change A to Section 4, et cetera, before you knew that the LEM would work so well? There were similar, I believe, in other words, before the launch.
Yes, but I believe the primary test we had there We just found out there was no time in the flight plan to do them. If you're talking about those tests that were in the first 5 days, we made several modifications. And to my recollection, the primary deletions were in the area of communications.
I did observe in the course of the mission that some substantial number of these tests that were deleted in favor of doing them later. In other words, they'd been planned earlier to get an early hack on whether things were working for a later event. I recall the testing of the rendezvous radar as an example, because it was known that that would be picked up later, but being deferred, it just might be a little bit of a problem if it was found later. So there were a large number of them that were, in fact, just delayed to a later point in the mission. Gene might have a better feel, because he was doing a lot of it.
Okay, but I still feel the primary question was related to the pre-mission flight plan, the one that was put out about T-minus, I believe, about 6 weeks, as opposed to the final flight plan that came out about T-minus 2 weeks.
I simply had a general impression that there is a category of tests, of which there are a great many in the flight plans, which, when it becomes either a matter of time or a matter of simply too much work to accomplish, are relatively easily deleted. And I wonder if that's true, and there are, you know, it turns out that there are dozens, and so you can easily dispense with some.
Well, all of them or any one of them would be nice to have if we had some systems anomalies that we then had to chase down, because then out of these tests we could get all the engineering answers we would need to really understand those systems anomalies. We try, from the engineering sense, to put as many of these in as possible when we first develop a flight plan, and then as we get more and more experience with a plan, we start taking them out because we know we can't do them all, and we take more out in real time. But in retrospect now, after having flown LEM for these many days and given it the workout for 3 days, my first analysis is that we have lost nothing by not doing these tests.
Bill? I'd like to go back to Ed DeLong's question to General Phillips relative to the navigational uncertainties due to mass cons and other anomalies on the moon. And I believe that General Phillips invited Chris and George Lowe to answer if they chose about this. I'd like to find out how important more information in orbit around the moon is to the safety of astronauts on 11 and what the status of the planning for number 10 is at the present time with regard to the stay time in orbit around the moon.
Let me start out from a sort of square one here. What we have really committed to in the F mission is the broad objectives of the F flight plan, and that is to take the LEM to the moon, to perform a rendezvous around the moon, to come back out of lunar orbit and come home. Now that is the broad objective. Now, General Phillips has not seen a detailed flight plan, nor do we even have a completed detailed flight plan. And therefore, that's the reason he's unable to comment on the details of his acceptance of that flight plan, which we have not yet even given to him. We are in a transitory position here of trying to figure out the best way to get the most information in, without any major effects on propulsion requirements or time requirements. We are able to add, for instance, an additional astronaut day around the moon and still not add a total day to the total mission, because instead of taking the time and coming back from the moon with the propulsion we have available, we just spend it around the moon and then come home. The whole purpose and what Ed had in mind and what he got from me several weeks ago was a plan to get some additional navigational information, which is of very great importance to us, to the navigation requirements on the G mission. And let me discuss that a minute. From the 8 mission, we were able to get a good correlation, anyway, for the inclination we were traveling on of what the downrange position change was as we went around the moon. And we're interested here in being able to predict ahead. We can measure where we are very precisely with the radar we have from the ground, but that's not the problem. The problem is predicting approximately two orbits ahead as to where you you're going to be when you start the power descent. We have to take a navigational fix with the spacecraft and then predict ahead approximately 2 revs from that navigational fix. What I'm trying to drive at here is that we, in the downrange position of the orbit, where you are in that orbit, we've been able to see that that's a linear thing and one which we can approximate with an empirical mathematical equation and correct for. However, when we started to try to get altitude from the measurements we took from Apollo 8, we had 2 measurements with a telescope and 1 measurement with a sextant, and they did not correlate. And we've had trouble trying to find out and determine which one is right, and frankly, we don't know. And we're probably not going to come up with that answer. So what we did was say, okay, in F, what we'd like to do is a similar type thing. We'll do it 4 times on different sites using the sextant to try to get some corollary data to see if there's any linear displacement of altitude for that particular inclination that we can then come up with an empirical fix for this prediction method. And that's what we're up to here in this flight plan, is to try to come up with some navigational fix for doing that.
Well, then this almost sounds to me, from what you've said, that it would be foolhardy to fly G without flying F.
No, that's not entirely true, because we do have some ideas already from the data we got from Apollo 8 and the lunar orbiter data to come up with a better prediction scheme than we had originally. Or from the standpoint of mass cons, if you want to call that, around the moon, if that's what they are, by the way. That's just one plausible answer. But the errors that we're dealing with, we mathematicians, or the mathematicians speak to we engineers, in terms of 3 sigma limits. And they're trying to be pure about this thing and trying to stay within these 3 sigma limits. If we're in a 1 sigma case, which is the case you're in most of the time, then we probably wouldn't have a problem in the power descent. However, if you were in a 3 sigma case, that could be altitude errors of, say, approximately 7,500 to 10,000 feet. That would not be good when you started the power descent, because if we don't get the landing radar in until we get about at the 30,000 foot level, we're only able to correct out an error of about 4,000 to 5,000 feet. So if you went in with a 3 sigma error, and let's say the platform, the inertial platform, thought it was at an altitude 10,000 feet above where it really was, and then the landing radar came in and started trying to correct that, we would not be able to correct that big an error by the time we got to the point where we would be satisfied and we'd have to abort the mission.
And one final question that's kind of related. Do you have a primary landing site for the G mission at the present time? If not, when will it be chosen?
We have 4 sites which would normally be used. We have 5 sites, 4 of which are available to us on the G mission if it goes in July, and the same would be true in August. Or so we have four sites which would open a window and give us about a 7-day span in the nominal case. It would depend on the declination of the moon at the time we went. It would either be the one that's in the north or the south or the farthest west.
Is it possible to... Could someone please try to compare the performance of the lunar module in its first manned flight with the performance of the Apollo Command module in 7?
I think they were both outstanding. I can't... I don't know how to express it in any other way. We came through with using all of the primary systems. We had a minimum number of abnormal conditions, 2 or 3 that have been discussed before, that really in no way influenced the mission. And certainly the performance of the LEM in this first flight far exceeded my expectations, as did the command module in Apollo 7. They're both, I think, outstanding spacecraft.
Will there be any significant fixes that you can see at this time to be made with the lunar module? For example, the difficulty they had seeing the COAS when they were trying to...
Well, as you know, we asked them to bring the COAS back to find out whether it was malfunctioning or not. I don't think it was right now, but... until we talk to the crew, we really don't know what we have to do with that. It's conceivable that we have to change the optics in it or make the light brighter or something. But remember, this is a separate device that's about the size of a flashlight. And if that's all we have to worry about and all we have to fix out of this flight, then I'll be pretty darn pleased.
Mark Bloom.
Two questions. One, a follow-up on this. Are there any significant worries left about the lunar module from the standpoint of systems for landing it on the moon?
One big one, the landing radar, which we couldn't test.
Let me add to that for a second, Chris. Also, the fact that we've had experience with it in only one manned flight. In other words, the total amount of flight experience with a LEM is still considerably less than we've had with the command module at this time.
Okay, and the second question is referring to General Phillips' 101% of success on 7 and even better on 8. Now, if we can build a model such that we would have a successful reentry tomorrow, would we at this point have more than 100% of success on Apollo 9? If we splash down tomorrow, okay. If you decide to come in, we splash down tomorrow, okay, and we came in here and we ask you, do we have 100% of success, what would you add to?
Let me try and answer that one. We, as General Phelps indicated, have completed all of the mandatory primary objectives on the mission today. There are secondary objectives, including landmark sightings, which will be conducted with the balance of the time remaining. In addition, we plan to use the SO-65 experiment, which you will hear more of after this briefing, and I think that has a potentially very substantial contribution to make to the Earth Resources Program. So those two specific items make the mission less than 100% complete today.
Okay, well, then maybe I'll go all the way down to the end of the table. And Gene Kranz told me some time ago that Apollo 9, if we had all success, was 150% of success.
I guess that was my personal feelings on the subject.
All right.
I think all of us said at the beginning that we would be extremely surprised if we accomplished everything because it was an extremely difficult mission to fly. And I think that's what prompted Gene's statement, and I sure would agree with it.
Ed Clark. I said this already. It's a real-time one sigma question. If you got up to the moon on 10 and you took your four sights with a sextant, is this a problem you can solve there? In other words, could you decide after taking these sightings that you understood the altitude prediction situation well enough that you might then go ahead and make a landing based on that, or do you have to bring the homework home and run it through computers here and study the whole situation further?
It's the latter. It takes a lot of fitting of data, Ev, to come up with the answers to this thing. We've been working on the Apollo 8 data ever since it landed, even before that, as a matter of fact, from the tracking data we had and the computer data that we were able to read out, and it took us up till about 2 or 3 weeks ago to understand really what we had.
So that this altitude question is a critical enough question that at the moment anyway, you would not feel that a landing is very likely on 10.
Well, I don't want to say that this is a critical go-no-go situation. I don't want to leave you with that impression, because if it is a one sigma case, which we will know when we're there, then you could use that. We just want to have the best feeling we can when we start this powered descent. There are a number of other things that are the F mission are probably equally as important to us from that point of view, and such as the timelines. You could see in this mission that the timeline of getting ready to go into the LEM was extremely important, and it took us a couple of days to get that straightened out. What we'd like to see is a run of the G timeline, which is exactly what we have in the F mission, of getting the LEM ready and getting ready to do the powered descent maneuver, which is exactly the simulation we're going to do down to the 50,000-foot level on the F mission.
Go ahead, Harry.
Listening to the air-to-ground, it sounded as if there were a lot of little things that went a little bit wrong. And would you, gentlemen, I'm sure that you know more about them than I do. I don't have to catalog them. But would you comment on the things you saw that didn't go quite perfectly and whether you consider them important or not, what you consider most important among the things that didn't hit on the button?
I think I'll give my opinion, and I think it'd probably be good to pass it over to Stu here. I think what you saw really was the inner workings of the ground and the crew in getting the job done. This was our first opportunity to look at this particular work schedule the crew was working to, and I think frequently in the process of working with their checklist, the crew would occasionally omit, or else we would possibly give them some information that in our haste was not exactly correct. Now, it's a function of being exactly correct, because we're striving for as perfect a set of conditions to set the crews up as we possibly can. And I guess you'd say that a lot of the air-to-ground chatter was more in the area of tweaking up the operation. So I think that's basically what you saw, a lot of tweaking to set up the most perfect end conditions we could. Stu?
Yeah, I'd certainly agree with that. I did most of the talking today. In fact, I guess all of it. I really don't believe I'm with you on what you might be talking about. I guess if you're coming up on LOS and there's what we consider an important step that's going to be taking place before you get them again, we'll toss in a few reminders. We did have a couple of corrections to the checklist that due to the orbit that we were in versus the nominal pads or the nominal orbit they might have had that were corrections, but these were just real-time operational corrections as you went along, and I really...
As one who was sort of sitting back and watching Gene and Stu operate, I was impressed by the perfection of the whole thing. We watched the onboard guidance on both spacecraft and the ground track and the communications between the two spacecraft and with the ground. And Chris and I were sitting back there with Dr. Gilruth and we're just astounded by how perfect things went all the way.
It's probably my faulty understanding, but what I'm thinking of is things like that. What sounded like a major drop in the oxygen surge tank pressure and the AGS caution and warning light, and apparently indifferent functioning of the capture latches. Were these all procedural or misunderstood by us?
I think we're talking about systems here that are extremely complicated, and what in the talking that goes on might be misinterpreted, such as the AGS warning light. That light was on. It certainly didn't affect the function of the AGS as we could see, and it's got a signal on it, and the bulb is burning. You get these in airplanes sometimes, and you can take the cover off and unscrew the bulb, which they can't do in the limb. But the other things about the capture latches, we really don't have enough data to say anything on that one. It released, and it hooked back up, and they got docked, and... without much trouble, I would really think it worked well.
I'd like to say something about this caution and warning thing, because I'm famous for clipping wires on the caution and warning system. The caution and warning system is extremely difficult to build from the standpoint of knowing where to set the limits. And because of the sophistication of that system, when you start building these systems, you think that the limits are going to be in certain places, and they end up being differently. The temperatures are slightly lower or higher than you expected them to be in terms of where you wanted to warn the crew. And this is what happened in the AGS testing, I suspect, that we had a slightly out of voltage or a slight out of frequency that caused the caution and warning light to come on. And it was acceptable, but here it is now, and you can't change that limit. And that's the problem you face with in this sort of thing continuously. I think the capture latches might well be the same way. It's the first time we've had that system up there under those environmental conditions. And we may find that it takes a certain procedure to get the capsule launches to work under those conditions.
Rudy Abrams.
Chris, since the perturbations of the orbit on Apollo 8 didn't quite match the model, does this mean that on the F mission that the rendezvous will have to be made entirely with onboard calculations, and how close have the onboard solutions today been with what you were getting on the ground?
Okay, and that's a very good question, because it's probable that around the moon, the MSFN calculations will be nowhere near the accuracy required to do the rendezvous. And and that's because of our inability to predict ahead with this kind of data. The onboard calculations today were extremely accurate both in the CSM and the LEM by comparison with the ground, where we do have a good comparison with the C-band track that we have around the Earth. Now, with the CSM in the F mission, we have an additional capability. We have VHF ranging, which we do not have on this spacecraft today. And it is my belief that with the additional computation strength that we have in the CSM for that flight and the onboard calculations that LEM has, that that provides the real safety that's required to give you two solutions.
Go ahead, Bill.
I wonder if somebody can supply this for the historical record. Is this the first post-recovery conference we've had prior to recovery?
I guess I don't consider the post-recovery conference.
Are we going to have a post-recovery conference?
I expect we will. Yes. We always have.
Go ahead, John Lane.
There was a reference in the transcript today to a failure of a heater in one of the two OPS units on the LEM. I'm wondering if someone could enlighten me on that and whether or not it would have affected an EVA exit had the docking mechanism not worked after the rendezvous.
First of all, we don't know whether we had a heater failure itself. We are unable to get automatic operation of the heaters in the hydrogen tanks, or fuel cell hydrogen. I say automatic operation. We still have...
OPS.
I'm sorry.
I guess we have to get some more data on that. We asked the crew to redo that test, and we didn't have time to talk with them about it before we left over there. The answer to the second one is no, it would not have. The PLEOS or the backpack was still good, and the other OPS, and that's all you needed to make a transfer in case you couldn't get done.
To clarify that, we don't really know whether it was a failure of the heater or a failure of the test circuit that tests the heater.
The heater warms up the oxygen as it comes out of the oxygen bottle, so it doesn't freeze and it regulates.
It's a two-stage valve which gets freezing.
It may well have just been a malfunction of the light. It may have been a procedure not switching it on far enough. We did ask the crew to try again before they left the LEM to work the switch, and we have not heard back from them as to what that showed.
Louis DeRoe.
Now that the Apollo 9 astronauts have much less work to do, do you intend to let them have a little more rest, like sleeping longer?
France?
Gene, you want to answer
that? Going to get any more rest. I have to answer that. Be yes.
For the rest of the mission? Certainly. Certainly.
Yes. Two questions. One is, can anybody tell us at this point how far out of the limb Schweikert got yesterday, and whether you feel that that's essentially an EVA, most of what you wanted to know?
Well, the same question was asked me yesterday, and we still don't have any. Of course, the timeline is so busy, we have not had any time at all to sit down and recap anything. He was out on the handrails. He evaluated the handrails to the perfect satisfaction of both he and Jim. Jim did recap it to the fact that he said that Rusty proved out the handrails as a way to transfer between the vehicles, and that he was perfectly happy with it.
The other question has to do with the navigation during the rendezvous. You essentially had three sets of numbers, I believe. Gumdrop, Spider, and the ground, and I wonder on the basis of whose figures was most of the maneuvering done today. Was Spider pretty much going on what it had on board?
I think
with other, using the others as secondary and tertiary?
As far as I know, he burned the Lim Ping solution on every burn, and they were within the tolerance. We have the rules set up to, in the order of priorities that you're going to go, but they were all in the ballpark, and they were all real good, and the Lim Pings was the big actor as far as I know.
General Phillips, has any consideration at all been given to shortening the Apollo 9 flight plan? And if so, at what point do you think you could bring them back and get all of the secondary objectives that you want to get done and give them a chance to rest up for the reentry period?
We discussed some weeks before the mission flew the possibility of shortening it, since we knew that we would achieve these primary objectives early in the mission, and decided at that time that there's much we can learn about our equipment and our people by staying up there for the planned 10 days duration. I still believe that that's the case, and I think most of us do. I know that Deke Slayton expects the crew to get kind of bored and other people to get kind of bored. But I remember saying on a previous mission that I'll be the happiest man in the world if we're all bored during the balance of this mission, because there is a lot to learn in terms of people, equipment, time. Now, we always face the possibility of having to bring a mission down earlier or early if there's a problem that warrants bringing it down. I haven't really tried to look at the exact curve of development test objectives to see exactly when we reach 100%. I think maybe George has taken a look at it. Have you got an opinion on that?
We're within about 3% of having completed all of the objectives today.
Okay, and one more. If I may back into this FG question from another direction, from what we've heard today, you've still got the landing radar to test. George Lowe says one of the big things that you'd like to have is more time on the LEM before attempting a landing. The F mission would run the G timeline and check it out. There's this question of navigation. From looking at all of these things that F would add, what in the world would be any advantage to skipping F and going on to G? Are there some advantages, tangible advantages?
Well, let me ask Chris to comment first, and I might pick it up with that.
Well, I can't think of any. I'm an F proponent, and I really feel that we need more time on the limb, and the best place to get it, now that we, I think, have confidence in the limb, is around the moon.
The limb doesn't care whether it's around that's the moon or the
when you separate it from a... around from the command module, it's better to do the rendezvous around the moon because that's where it was designed to perform its mission. So I really feel that most of us in the engineering aspects of the program feel that we need more time on the limb, and the best place to do it is around the moon because that's where we're going to get the most engineering information. Now there are many management concepts that have to be considered on top of that, and what we do is make our engineering proposals, and then they get evaluated.
I would elaborate one other point to try to further answer your question. You can make a judgment, although it has to be somewhat subjective, as to how much risk is involved in each mission we fly, and within each mission, how much risk is involved in each of the pieces that make up the mission. And there is an argument which says that you take a risk every time you make a manned flight, and I know, and I believe most of you know, that that's so. We think we've brought that risk down to quite low levels and very reasonable levels. And we believe we're developing a system that we'll have confidence in, that we do have confidence in when we fly. So the point of this other argument, to try to cite one of the advantage or the arguments on the other side, is that an F mission in itself involves a certain finite amount of risk to fly that mission. But the argument you have to consider then is how much does flying that F mission reduce the risk of flying the landing mission with the F preceding it? And it's somewhat subjective, but there is an argument that says the least number of times you fly to get to the landing is the least amount of risk. Now, I want to conclude on this point by saying that there are several reasons why landing without the F mission may well make the risk of that final mission, the landing mission, intolerably high.
Pete Caldwell.
There have been a couple of times now that we've flown as Apollo with one man for the first time during this mission. And I was just wondering, could we get some kind of a hack on how Scott flew the CSM on his own as regards fuel conservation and, I mean, how the fuel that he used compared to the nominals that had been budgeted, and get some idea of how efficiently the one-man operation was carried out?
As far as performing the mission, flew it extremely well, stayed right on the timeline from what I could get as far as the marking schedule and everything, kept well up with it and are ahead of it. He appeared to never be behind at any point, which, of course, in a mission like this, you just can't afford to. He was troubled by caution and warning coming on, but as you probably know, by his cryotank. No, this was the condenser exhaust on the fuel cell. The fuel budget, I think they're still refining the data on that one, and I really don't have a good hack on it. I know the LIM RCS was above, and we were clocking right by, well above any of the red lines that we had throughout the mission. Gene's probably got.
I think to give a comment on the fuel management, our initial down, we initially went down about 20 pounds per quad. Right off the bat during the initial transposition and docking. If you remember, that's when we had our quad C, quad D anomaly. And the crew had some problem getting into attitude for the actual docking maneuver. Since then, we've deviated only about 20 more pounds per quad below nominal. Now, this is the first time we've ever estimated RCS usage of this type. It's always generally been associated with purely translational maneuvers, attitude maneuvers, that type of stuff, as opposed to a very active station keeping. From our standpoint, we are all the way through the rendezvous, we've been well above our red lines. At the present time, we're reasonably close to some of our backup deorbit red lines, and those are the ones we're watching now. But I think from a standpoint of fuel management, it's been excellent in both spacecrafts.
I'd like to answer that since I'm the software man, Mr. Cranes. The point you should remember here is that on this flight, he had to do all of his computations based on sextant sightings. He did an excellent job there because we did not have tracking during the dark side because the light was out. He could not see the limb, and he had to get a number of marks when he got back out in daylight. He was able to correct the errors that had built up in the inertial system and get it back so that his final solutions in the rendezvous were extremely close to those that the limb had and that the ground had. The point I want to make there also is that in the next spacecraft, we have VHF ranging, so that the sextant tracking there will only be as a backup to the VHF ranging. He will also have the capability to perform the CSI, CDH computations on board, which again will make it even more simple for him.
One more. Could you give us some idea of how accurate his sextant trackings were compared to, say...
Yeah, he was within about 1.5 feet per second, I think, of the final solution.
We'll take one more question right here, and then we'll have to...
Yeah, I was wondering if you could give us some insight on the decision process involved. It must have been some time ago, of course, on not flying an unmanned landing with the LEM during the Apollo 10, since you still have the one major system, the landing radar, to check out.
Are you asked? Well, of course, the decision process concerning an unmanned LEM landing really had its beginnings in 1961 and 62. I guess
Seriously.
Glad to take a crack at it.
Well, let me comment first. It really was in 1962 and on into 63 when the LOR mode and the basic layout of the total Apollo system was made, that the judgment was made that an unmanned landing with the LEM was not a valid thing to do in the progression to prove out the systems and to develop the capability for a combination of automatic equipment and manual control to successfully make that landing. That decision has been questioned from time to time since by different groups and different people, and we've reassessed it each time it's been questioned and been able to satisfy ourselves and those who question us that it's not that the progression to a landing without an unmanned landing is a sound way to proceed. We've fairly recently re-examined the case and again concluded that we're in very good, solid shape to proceed onto a manned landing without an unmanned landing.
One more quickie. Are you bringing back the dead OPS for autopsy?
No, we're not. In no way.
Thank you very much. And the SO-65 briefing will start shortly.